This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From our interview with Nico Wunderling, in past ages, when the Greenland ice sheet melts, that initiates other tipping points, from changes to the North Atlantic currents that keep Europe warm in the winter, to rainfall over the Amazon. Greenland ice water even raises warm ocean waters, eating away at the base of marine glaciers in Antarctica. It goes pole to pole. Research on the past and multiple present models tell us Greenland tips towards losing its ice cap somewhere around 1 to 1.5 degrees C warmer than pre-industrial times. We are already there. Greenland ice has begun to melt. As we warm further, other major Earth systems will tip in a cascade. A few scientists are beginning to say it. It is too late to stop climate change. Now the fight to keep the climate we need to survive begins. Yes, the COVID-19 pandemic rages on despite all the comforting talk about reopening and it's over. The wave moves around, currently swamping Russia, Eastern Europe, and parts of Asia. About 2,000 Americans are killed by COVID daily. That's not big news, hey? It's high in the UK, too. No doubt the tens of thousands of people flying to Scotland for the COP26 climate conference will spread more disease around the world. We see what a single novel virus can do to our lives and the world economy. Now picture a whole age of ancient viruses returning to the surface of the earth. That's just part of the package of threats emerging from the far north as the permafrost thaws. We need to investigate.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The novel COVID-19 virus dramatically changed all our lives, that's for sure. Now we learn dangerous microbes could be released in the far north, which is warming four times faster than the rest of the planet. Could thawing permafrost release old diseases like smallpox? Certainly forever toxic chemicals are returning out of the glaciers and permafrost. So is radioactive waste dumped in the frozen Arctic. Dr. Kimberly R. Miner specializes in these issues. She led the new paper, Emergent Biogeochemical Risks from Arctic Permafrost Degradation. Kimberly is a climate scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. She is also a firefighter and emergency planner. From Pasadena, Kimberly Rain Miner, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are talking about things reemerging from frozen ground that covers about a quarter of the Earth's surface. It includes old life forms and more recent industrial waste. Let's start at the micro level. Do you think COVID-19 spotlights the need to better understand microbial life, including from thawing Arctic lands?
There's been a number of folks in the epidemiological and policy communities who've worked their entire lives to get a hold on emergent viruses, diseases, and bacteria. But I do think that COVID has thrust it into the international community conversation a little bit more.
Okay, so in the Bible, Methuselah was the oldest human, supposedly living 969 years, and we give that name to an old tree in California that's about 5,000 years old. What are Methuselah organisms in the Arctic environment?
So, great question. That was a cheeky way that we were referring to microbes that are also known as extremophiles. These are organisms that are able to live in really challenging conditions, maybe really hot, really cold temperature, high pressure environments. And they're able to live up to a million years that we've discovered so far in permafrost, which is in some places a high pressure, low temperature environment, some places just a low temperature environment.
But how can anything stay viable in any form for tens of thousands of years in bitter cold? How is that possible?
So there's a number of different strategies that organisms use, and we do discuss this in the paper. Some organisms have lipid membranes that they employ. Some of them use methodologies to update and maintain their DNA. There's a number of different ways that organisms do this, but It's something that we have seen in a variety of ecosystems on the planet, and that is also a potential for the kind of organisms that we might find on other planets.
Well, we need to keep our balance and not fall into irrational fears. Your study and other scientists do suggest that the chances of a COVID-like disease coming out of thawing permafrost is, quote, improbable. But haven't there been cases of strange diseases?
So the movement from a physical substrate to a vector, a host body, if you will, is not exactly a linear progress, right? So in the anthrax outbreak that I think you're referring to in Siberia, the thought was that it was actually spread by reindeer to the human host. And so there's a number of different ways that these organisms travel, and it's really important to have a warm body vector in many of the cases. So it would take a lot, let's just say, to go from a thawing permafrost substrate to a human environment, specifically one that is not co-located with the permafrost in the far north.
Is it also probable that some new life forms emerging from the frozen north will be helpful?
Yeah, we cover a couple of these in our paper. There are some findings that suggest that there are microbes that are evolving to take care of or, consume or change toxic waste. So whether that's oil or it's other types of organic and inorganic human-derived chemicals, it looks like there may be some adaptations that these microbes are able to employ to help remove them from the environment. Although that is not what we should be relying on, I think it's probably a better idea to keep toxic waste where they belong and not in the environment.
Is it possible some Arctic microbes will go extinct as their environment rapidly warms and the permafrost thaws?
Yeah, exactly. So there's a couple different ways that this could play out. Organisms that have maintained stasis could go extinct. There is a potential that they may compete with modern organisms that have different adaptations than the organisms constrained in permafrost. And we don't really know how that's going to play out. We don't know how things are going to respond to climate change, if the extremophilic microbes are going to be able to survive better under challenging climate conditions, or if they will, as you mentioned, survive worse and potentially go extinct.
The key here, I think, is the rate. Last March on Radio EcoShock, Johannes Lohmann from the University of Copenhagen warned the rate of climate change may be more important than the amount when you get to impacts. And in 2019, I interviewed Canadian scientist Merit Turetsky about abrupt permafrost thaw. What did you find about the rate of warming when it comes to permafrost releases?
Yeah, thank you. So we have another paper coming out in a couple weeks, and Merit is the co-author on that. And we are really interested in this abrupt permafrost thaw dynamic, where you may have a loss of ice and therefore structure for the permafrost in a really rapid time period. You might lose a whole side, a whole cliff of permafrost, for example, in a couple weeks to a couple months. And the thing that we were interested in this paper with those dynamics is that that potentially means that deeper microbes that have been buried for more time could be emergent in a rapid event, and then potentially be transported downstream or into the local atmosphere. And at that point, it's a little bit difficult to know how things will progress. But these abrupt warming events are a challenge because they are, as I mentioned, unpredictable, but also have the potential to expose microbes that are not co-evolved in these ecosystems in a really rapid way.
Well, let's talk about all our pollution dropping down and landing into the Arctic ice and into the Arctic frozen lands and then becoming part of them. But now they're starting to thaw. What kinds of toxic chemicals are emerging as it does thaw?
So I've been with you before, Alex, talking about DDT and PCBs emerging from glaciers, and that was a study we did in Alaska looking at the impacts of DDT in the local ecosystems and risk to humans. For this paper, we indexed nuclear waste and nuclear fallout from permafrost containment areas and from scuttled nuclear submarines. Mercury and other heavy metals that are transported through a variety of substrates and animals. And then you've also got a number of organic chemicals that, like you said, travel atmospherically and then are deposited in the far north to be entrained both in ice and in permafrost. So there's a couple different categories that we go through in the paper, but the bottom line is that none of these compounds you want to really release into the Arctic environment. And in some ways, one of the more pristine remaining environments on the planet could be impacted by this surge of toxic materials as the permafrost continues to thaw.
Yeah, it's kind of bad news. Some of the chemicals, like PCBs, were banned, and DDT is very much regulated. We thought, well, that should end the problem, but now it's sort of coming back to haunt us. Are we already measuring, for example, increased mercury contamination in Arctic plants and animals?
Yeah, I think increased mercury contamination has been a concern for a while, to the point where folks who do a lot of fishing in the far north are asked to consider mercury consumption regularly. There was a paper that we referenced by Kevin Schaefer and his team looking at mercury flow throughout the permafrost ecosystem. So some of that is normal, natural from rock, and some of that is deposited by humans. But this increased flow of both water and materials as the permafrost goes from being a hard frozen substrate to kind of like a muddy soup is definitely an emerging concern that we were trying to track and start talking about more closely.
Kimberly, why are the levels of persistent organic pollutants higher in plants and animals than what could be found and measured in the surrounding thawing soil?
So persistent organic pollutants have a couple little interesting behaviors that they do. So one of them is that when you disperse a POP, whether it's PCB or DDT, into the atmosphere, they travel around really well until they hit what has been termed a cold wall in the Arctic and Antarctic, where they're been taken into snow or rain and they fall to Earth. And then once they fall to Earth, they're really interested in, I guess, maybe interested isn't the right word, we don't need to anthropomorphize them, but they move towards lipids. And so they can be uptaken by plants and animals, especially those that have a lot of lipids, a lot of fat in the far north. And then contained within those cells for a good amount of time, often until the host gives it to another organism through a maternal lineage or consumption, or the host dies and then it goes back into the system and can be transported again. And these POPs, they don't really degrade on short time scales. So there's a lot of movement that can happen between organisms and between plants and animals, and they end up being recycled and the toxic properties are maintained.
Is it possible that chemical releases in a fast-warming Arctic could even affect clouds in the far north?
Yeah, it's possible. That's one thing that we're looking at. The ability of clouds to form is based on a number of different dynamics that are still very much under exploration. Depending on the ecosystem, but potentially sediments or little pieces of soil that are from the ground in the far north could help seed clouds. And then that could be the same for chemicals that are entrained in those sediments. So the sediment would go into the air and help seed clouds, and then those chemicals would have the ability to move out of the far north again.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are investigating threats coming from rapidly thawing Arctic lands. Our guest is Dr. Kimberly Rainminer, lead author of a new study on emergent threats in the permafrost. In 1990, the Soviet Coast Guard arrested the crew of the vessel MV Greenpeace. The activists were heading to the remote Arctic island of Nova Zemlya, where nuclear-powered ships and all sorts of highly radioactive waste was dumped by the USSR. They thought eternal cold would store it, and now we see it won't. Talk to us about the nuclear burden left in Russia and how climate change could release it.
Thanks, Alex. So this is a really interesting thing that we found as we were going through documents, that there's a number of different ways that a lot of the Arctic powers have deposited nuclear waste into the oceans and soils of the Arctic. So that includes scuttling nuclear submarines. So that would be leaving a nuclear submarine to sink to the bottom of the ocean. There seems to be an indication that there was some testing of bombs and nuclear devices within the permafrost. So an area would be hollowed out, there would be testing, and then it would be closed down to store the fallout. So you can imagine that with any kind of permafrost thaw that has entrained fallout, that it might move into the larger ecosystem. The U.S. also scuttled a base, Camp Century, in Greenland. And that's right next to a nuclear airplane, or an airplane carrying nuclear weapons that crashed. So really peppered throughout the Arctic, there's a number of different crafts and accidents and bases that have nuclear waste somehow captured within them that are potentially going to be released as things continue to warm and thaw. So that's something that we recommend needs to be watched very closely and mitigated as best as these nations are able to in the near time.
Old people remember the first icebreaker to cross the Arctic Ocean. Now there's a polar shipping route for several months of the year, and tourists do cruises there too. Does this increase the risk of transporting a newly released microbe or other toxic materials from that thawing permafrost?
You know, one of the things that we mention is that the probabilistic models are really not there as far as human transport, but I think it follows that the more people who interact with an environment, the more impact they have and the more impact the environment has on them. So, for example, transporting soil in the treads of tires or shoes that could move things. It could be samples that are taken or backpacks that are filled with some kind of material, whether it's plants or animal. So, yeah, I think that the more that we interact with the Arctic in a more populated way, more people travel to the Arctic, there increases the opportunity for a negative interaction or a higher risk profile.
A number of scientists brought back ancient microbes to university labs trying to revive them. First, have they done it? And second, isn't that a danger in itself, say, from accidental release?
You know, we do mention that although I'm sure people are following proper lab techniques and sterility requirements, it is really important to think about these things and think about the dangers and risk profiles. So it is an important topic to discuss, but just like any of the epidemiological labs around the U.S., there are standards in place, and it's just important for people to follow them.
You know, you work at JPL. It's almost like coming back from space to come back from this new Arctic in a way.
You know, and we are making that analogy. We are pioneering some new studies on permafrost using tools from the Mars rover, and we're interested in understanding if the permafrost could be a proxy for microbes, how to look for extraterrestrial microbes on other planets, and maybe that this would be a good way to understand where to start.
That is so cool. So talk to us about the risk of antibiotic resistance in emerging Arctic organisms.
So a number of groups have done work looking at the potential for antibiotic resistance, and they have found some microbes that predate antibiotics that do have resistance for a variety of different reasons. So that is a concern. It's definitely something that, again, needs to be tracked and that we need to be aware of. At present, these microbes are not really interacting with humans. There's no reason that it should become a problem for them to interact with humans, but it's probably not ideal to have an increase of microbes that are antibiotic resistant in the environment. So that's something that needs to be discussed, I think, and that we're hoping to continue to raise as an issue.
In all of this, we have to know the front line for this experiment in polar warming are the indigenous people of the Arctic, and this is another unfair impact of global warming on those who had the least emissions of carbon, chemicals, or nuclear materials, certainly. In this and coming generations, they may pay the first price. Does that increase our responsibility to act?
Well, I am not a policy expert, so I guess my personal opinion is that people who are suffering from climate change do need to be considered strongly, and it needs to be something that all nations are willing to work towards, is protecting people who are dealing with climate change right now, just as we would hope they would continue to do so in the future. But our work really hopes to inform the current state of the science so that policymakers can make the best decisions for the constituents that they represent.
When I recorded permafrost scientists at the 2012 American Academy annual meeting, they viewed thawing permafrost as a steady process, thawing the ground incrementally, likely over thousands of years. Almost 10 years later, how does that sit with what we really know?
So there is a steady process of permafrost thaw and oftentimes refreeze. There's what we call an active layer, which is named that because it is the most active layer of permafrost, right? So every summer there would be thaw, and then every winter there would be refreeze. But the model that Merit Trutsky suggested with abrupt thaw has really changed that. We know now that there are more pulse events of thaw going on in addition to these gradual thaw dynamics. And that's something that all of the communities, from modeling to remote sensing to forecasting, are trying to get a better hold of, because it introduces a new and more unpredictable dynamic into a permafrost thaw system.
And it's not a plain system. When you look at maps of actual permafrost thaw, they're like islands of them, and whole areas pop up and other areas are not, and there's all different geology underneath it. There's a lot of work to do. What would you say some of the research priorities for the next 10 years should be?
So I think there's so many that have to do with the Arctic. Specifically with the work that we were just looking at, I think it's important to get a better handle on which microbes are where, what the profiles look like. So what do the oldest microbes look like, and what are their mechanisms for survival, all the way up to the most recent, and how could they potentially interact with the environment. We're very interested in doing flow modeling as well, so understanding how some of the anthropogenic chemicals, nuclear waste, have the potential to move and flow throughout the environment, whether they're transported downstream in water or they're transported into the near atmosphere. As always, international collaboration on monitoring a huge piece of land like the Arctic represents is really critical and is going to be a really important part of moving forward as a global community. So that's something that we really strongly advocate for, is building and maintaining those strong relationships.
From the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, we've been speaking with Dr. Kimberly Rain Miner. Find links to Kimberly and the Nature Communications paper, Emergent Biogeochemical Risks from Arctic Permafrost Degradation, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kimberly, thank you for keeping watch over that cold frontier.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.